actually on the 101 Sensations long list. I'm hoping that most of you have seen the 101 Sensations publicity, which is just on the entrance to the hall today. Essentially, the 101 Sensations scheme is a scheme that's trying to get everybody in Coventry to vote for their favourite read, based on a long list of 101 titles, which is the whole reason for the 101 Sensations title, if you like. So, obviously, Maggie's one of the authors on that long list, and we're aiming to get various authors on that long list to come and host events. And Maggie's the second of the authors to actually agree to do that. So, if you could get voting, that would be great. In terms of Maggie, obviously, I don't know how many of you are aware of Maggie's works, but Maggie's the author of 9 novels now, The White Family being the 8th novel that she wrote, and obviously The Flood the 9th. And essentially, The White Family tells the story of a family growing up with the perils of racism in modern British society. So rather than boring you anymore, I'll hand you over to Maggie and hope that she can enthrall you more than I can. So thank you, Maggie.
Thank you, Mark. I don't suppose anybody would feel like moving you down a bit, would they? Maybe? Would that be all right? Just thinking it might be easier to ask questions then. I don't mean I'm going to ask you questions. I mean you might ask me questions. Thank you. Thank you very much. Everybody all right? Okay, can I just ask another question? Was anybody here when I read From the White Family at Warwick Arts Centre before? So I don't have to worry too much about reading the same passage then. That's all I'm asking. Okay, well, I'll begin by saying I am really pleased to be here tonight because of this idea of the 101 books that the libraries are going to vote on. This book has had a different kind of life to my other novels. And one of the things that has been terrific for me is that it's been read by readers groups, but really quite widely in the UK. And that's something you only tend to find out about as a writer accidentally. Maybe on the internet, or somebody will contact my publisher asking for a bit of information, and then I find out readers groups are reading me, and then perhaps if they're asked, they come back with a bit of feedback. And to me, it is genuinely much more interesting what readers are saying in their reading groups than what is said in a review, because a review is a professional piece of work that is written for a purpose and that's paid for. And there are all sorts of things, I think, that affect reviews that don't affect what goes on in readers' groups. So it's been fascinating to me that readers' groups have liked this book. And this book also is now nominated for the Dublin Impact Literary Award, which again is a library-generated thing. And 3 libraries have recommended The White Family for that award. One in Finland, I think, and 2 others. So this book has had a different kind of life. I actually wrote this book. I started writing this book in 1994, which is a hell of a long time ago. So it's odd that this book, when I write about this book, when I read this book now, I have a different feeling about it. It was published in 2002. It took, therefore, 7 years, 2001, actually, it took 7 years to get published. The only book of mine that took that long to publish was my first novel, which I wrote when I was 25 and published when I was 32. So my first novel and my 8th novel took the longest to publish. So those of you who are writers here, be encouraged. Sometimes a book that takes a very long time to publish can do quite well in the end. Okay, I want to leave plenty of time for questions, but I'm going to read from a passage about Alfred. Now, Alfred is the father of the White family, the patriarch, a slightly old-fashioned kind of father of a working-class British family. He's a park keeper, so he's a kind of patriarchal figure in terms of the park as well. The park is called Albion Park, so obviously I'm making it a kind of allegory of England. And this family is very divided in the way that I think British families often are. Alfred is in his 70s. He wasn't old enough to fight in the Second World War, but the Second World War, in a way, conditions all his attitudes, as I think they still condition a lot of our attitudes here in Britain. Wars like that, that kind of death, casts a very long shadow. He fought in Palestine, which is just after the war, during the Mandate, and that experience of fighting left him with a sense that he sacrificed a lot, that, as I think some veterans of the Second World War, they felt they went through a lot, and they had a great deal of hope in the 1950s, and some of those hopes have perhaps not come true. And I think a lot of prejudice against incomers comes from that sense of disappointment about some kind of dream, unreal dream, about what Britain was going to be. So, Alfred. This is halfway through the book, and so far we've only seen Alfred through his family, through his daughter, Shirley, who was married to a Ghanaian, Kojo, who she adored. And after Kojo's death, she marries a black British guy called Elroy. Also through Shirley's younger brother, Dirk. Dirk is the other side of the family. He's picked up all his father's prejudices and his resentment. He's a young man who can do nothing. He's not educated. He hasn't got a good job. He works in a newsagent. All he's got, really, he defines himself by his hatred. And his slight crush on his older sister means that his hatred and fear of black people is sharpened by the fact that his sister loves and marries two different black men. So for the first time here, Alfred appears from the inside. We've seen him as this dreadful patriarch. Now we see him suddenly vulnerable in hospital. He's just been given a diagnosis. He thought that he'd had a stroke, and he's just been told, this very prejudiced man, that in fact he has cancer. A very prejudiced man who's been told he has obstructions to his brain. Alfred lay shivering. I'll stand up to read if you don't mind. Alfred lay shivering slightly in bed. Sister had opened a lot of windows. Someone had died 5 beds down the ward. At least it's not me. But is it coming closer? Alfred knew he was too young to die, too young to be lying in hospital. I never expected to be here. Funny, isn't it, how life turns out? Hospitals were always for other people. Other people got ill and died. Other people took time off work. I never did. I never would. I suppose I despise people who got ill. I'm only 71, too young to die. I thought I could manage another 10. Doesn't seem right when I've always been fit, always eaten healthy and kept on my feet. A drink or two, in the past a smoke. Nothing that could explain getting cancer. I thought unhealthy people got cancer. It can't be cancer, they've made a mistake. But when the consultant had come round this morning, what he said seemed to leave no room for doubt. The doctor stood there, tall and thin, a gentleman with a thin, kind voice, a bit of a weed, Alfred might have thought once. And as he spoke, the whole world shifted. A cold weight of fear Alfred hadn't felt since he was first shot at in Palestine and suddenly knew he wasn't immortal, landed in his belly. And he started praying, "Please, Lord, no, may it not be true. Oh, please, Lord, no, may it not be true. Mr. White, do you understand me?" But Alfred hadn't heard a word he said after the first few deadening sentences. Then Alfred swallowed and fixed him with his eye. The man was looking at the lino. "So, it's cancer, you're saying, and you can't operate. We don't think an operation would be helpful." He repeated himself politely, firmly. "At your age, you see. So, I'm a goner because of my age. You're going to throw me on the scrap heap, are you?" A brief spurt of temper made Alfred feel better. The doctor and nurse both looked embarrassed. "Not at all, Mr. White, I do assure you. We'll do everything we can to make you comfortable." "So, it's hemlock, is it?" Alfred crowed at them. At least he was in control of them now. "I don't quite follow," said the doctor wearily. "I know about history. I went to school. I think you understand me, doctor." But suddenly all his energy left him, and the cold fluid began to leak through him, filling his veins with icy fear, and Alfred had to lie back on the pillows exhausted, which the doctor took as a sign to depart. "I might have years. People have years. People go on for years with cancer. Most things turn out all right in the end. We won the war, coming from behind. I got the job I always wanted. May married me, which I thought she never would. We had 3 kids, all of them healthy. Shirley got over her childhood asthma. I've always been fit. It'll help me now. If anyone's got a good chance, it's me. Besides, I'm needed. The park needs me, till they trained up another man. There used to be 6 of us. Unbelievable. They cut the jobs down one by one. Now there's just me. And if I go, I've sometimes wondered, will they ever replace me? They've kept cutting down, the council have. They've gone on weakening us year by year. The new idea is authority is bad. New idea is all softly, softly. For fear of upsetting people, they say. For fear of upsetting the coloured people. That's who they mean. We used to patrol the park in pairs, and each pair had an Alsatian with them. But no, they said people were getting upset. They said people felt we looked like policemen. They meant coloured people were getting upset. It's coloured people who don't like policemen, and ask yourself why. Why don't they like policemen? See, it's because of them they took our uniforms away. We had proper uniforms till a few years ago. Uniforms you would call uniforms. Nice black serge, very warm in winter, with silver buttons and a decent peak cap. Those uniforms were a godsend to us. The old days. The good old days. See, there weren't any coloureds when I was a kid. It was just a normal part of London. We were all the same. We were all one. No one was rich. We stuck together. May says, I do too much looking back. But sometimes I don't like to think about the future. Sometimes I think our world is ending. All the things we believed in, gone. Is it me that's ending? Me that's going? I'm going to stop there and see if you've got questions. And then if we've got time, I'm going to read on the end of that extract where things rather change. And you see a very different side of Alfred. Okay, because I know there are some people from readers' groups here, so I'll see if you've got some questions, and then I'll read some more. If you haven't got any questions, I'll read some more. Yes. Yes. I mean, I started it in 94 because Stephen Lawrence was murdered in 94, and that was the inspiration, because I wanted to understand a racial murder like that. I was really trying to see, you know, there's no point just shutting prejudice up. You've actually got to understand it, I think, see where it comes from. I don't think education has got an awful lot to do with it. It should have. But although there I'm showing a working class, uneducated man and his prejudices, I also kind of laugh at middle class prejudices. And I'm not sure that they've changed that much, actually. You know, education means people are careful with their language. And people are very good with their language. But I think prejudice shows in other ways, in things you think are not interesting to you or couldn't be interesting to you. I think in a lot of Britain, there are a lot of people still who don't have any black friends. I'm not sure that things have changed as much as they should. You know, the laws have changed. The follow-up to the Stephen Lawrence murder did change quite a lot of things in terms of institutions. But in my area of Brent, which is very, very mixed, I think it's got the highest concentration of, I don't like the phrase because it's a majority, but of ethnic minority population. It's not, it's a majority of anywhere in the country. But still, you hear these things. I hear this all the time, you know, on the bus, in a shop. I'm not saying we're worse than other countries. I think all countries have their prejudices. And I'm not saying that only white people are prejudiced. But I think it's a very interesting subject, why we hate people, and I'm not sure why we fear people. I'm not sure how much that's changed. Sorry, that's a very long answer. On the other hand, I am looking at people who, some of the people I'm looking at are older people. And so therefore the way they think will naturally be dated. Yes. Okay. That was any other questions? Yes. Well, in this passage, I think. I mean, you're always showing something with first-person interior monologue. It's always a bit of a challenge because you're showing things behind the back of the character, aren't you? So obviously at the end he's being sentimental when he's saying, you know, normal part of London, we were all one and all of that. He's looking back to a golden day that almost certainly never existed. And of course London has always had, well, we know as far back as probably the Roman Empire, we had black Londoners. And certainly since the 16th century, we've had black Londoners. So, you know, he doesn't know what he's talking about, in a sense. I think it's interesting because I think perhaps in the end, Alfred becomes more sympathetic. Now, that's a dangerous thing to do. But on the other hand, as a writer, in a way, you have to sympathize with your characters, even ones that in real life you wouldn't like. And I think, you know, well, as a writer also, maybe you're finding your own prejudices or vestiges of your own prejudice or things you've heard or things you've felt from your family, all of those things. In a way, I see a novel as an exploration. It's absolutely pointless setting out knowing what you think to write a novel. It wouldn't be interesting. And your characters, in a way, are ways of discovering parts of what you know and parts of what you think. To write a whole novel through a first person is very limiting, as I found. I've not done a whole novel through a first person, but I've done it through two first person narrators. But here, you see, you've got about eight first person narrators, so you're going to get lots of different views. Perhaps I'll read from Shirley. The other bit that I read, who's got a completely different Alfred's daughter, who doesn't have those kinds of prejudice at all. And she's kind of reacted against her dad very explicitly by looking for men who are not at all like Alfred. Because I don't know if you've seen, but quite very recently, in the past week, there's been a scientific survey, if surveys are ever scientific, that says that how often we base our choice of partner on our parents. Unconsciously, we do that very much. Well, obviously, when somebody very deliberately bases their choice of partner as somebody who doesn't look like their father. I mean, this is likely to be a father like Alfred, I should think, who is a very, very difficult father and quite a violent man. He is quite a violent man, both physically and in his attitudes. More questions? Yes. Yes.
How much do you think prejudice is passed down by family, or how much do you think it's by everyone who's
talking about
the media or any other society?
I don't know how much the media does. I think the basic ways in which we think, the basic ways, tend to be framed by childhood. And that, therefore, parents have quite a lot to do with it. Peer group. So if you grow up in a very multiracial area, multicultural area, I think you're likely to be probably less prejudiced. But again, if you're hearing drip, drip, drip all the time, these prejudice statements, I think unconsciously it can go in. In this book, the mother is much less, she isn't really prejudiced. But again, there's a very disrupting end because people don't behave. I mean, Alfred, you'll see, if you do read the book, you'll see that Alfred, the way Alfred acts is not predictable. And it's not necessarily the people who've got the most sanitized attitudes, the people who've got the officially best attitudes, who, when the crunch comes, are the people who behave well. You know, I don't think it's very predictable the way people are somehow. And the media, I don't know. The media has got all its protocols on this. You know, the media, in a sense, is very anti-racism. But in other senses, some of the choices it makes, I think you could see is, you could say there's a London agenda to a lot of, and a particular part of London agenda to the media. I mean, things like style supplements, you know. What are they about? They're about having a lot of money, and, you know, they are very exclusive in some ways, I think. Yes?
I was interested in, when you're writing first person perspective, and it was a very educated character, do you find it limiting not being able to use wrong words or have that original function?
Okay, it's Kurt. You maybe can't hear the questions. Could you hear that question? Okay, sorry, I'll repeat the question. If you're writing through first person, do you find it frustrating if you're using an uneducated character, not being able to have to use, as you're saying, long words or literary flourishes? I actually think that Alfred, there are moments when Alfred has a great deal of poetry, because I don't think you have to have long words to be poetic, and you can be literary in other ways. I mean, I think through structure and through, even with a character like Dirk, who is my racist boy, who is very, you know, he makes mistakes all the time. I actually enjoyed writing Dirk because I see him as a comic figure. My way of criticizing Dirk is by making him comic, and I find that enjoyable. Well, it would be limiting to write a whole book through Alfred. It would be a big challenge. I'm trying to think of, yes, Remains of the Day, Kazuo Ishiguro. That is a whole book through, I think it's through one consciousness, isn't it? Consciousness of the Butler. And I think that was a huge technical challenge. I think it's easier to use more than one first person myself. But it's very enjoyable. Writing first person, you do have very good access to your character. Yeah. It's very liberating, I think. Yeah.
Alfred's wife, May, was unusual in as much as she does have access to a tremendous amount of poetry. And I must admit, I found it slightly irritating every now and again when suddenly we burst into a piece of Tennyson.
This is Alfred's wife, May, who, although she's not formally educated, loves poetry, as my mother did. May is rather like my mother. And Alfred Tennyson is the other Alfred, you see. She's got this rather unromantic husband, this rather unrewarding, though very loving husband. And Alfred Tennyson, she loves. Yes, I was looking at a certain kind of Englishness, I think. And I also wanted to show that the person who's the most sensitive and literary is not necessarily the one who's going to make... And she's very against prejudice, isn't she? She reads James Baldwin, and she's heard of Martin Luther King, but, you know, May. I'm very fond of May, but she's a very mixed character. She's very afraid, isn't she? She's a very fearful character. And being afraid is that's limiting too, limiting in a different way, I think.
I've got a couple of questions, actually.
Okay, and then perhaps I'll read a bit of Shirley. Shall I read a bit of Shirley? That's the daughter who is very different.
I mean, I'm intrigued to know, obviously Dirk and Shirley grew up in the same environment.
Yes.
Yet Shirley is so obviously not racist in the sense that she's been partnered to men of colour, if you like.
Mm.
But Dirk is so obviously racist.
Mm.
Is the sole reason for that because Shirley has been partnered with two black men in the past, or do you think that he is more influenced by the father's opinions than Shirley was? And do you think that Shirley was so not influenced by it that that's why she ended up partnering with black men? Or do you think that she was attracted to the men rather than the colour?
I think it's to do, well, this is a very simplistic answer. Who knows why people are prejudiced? But my feeling about Dirk is he's not loved. He's got nothing. You know, his mother doesn't love him. His father doesn't really love him. He's a great disappointment to everyone. He's got a very gifted older brother who's doing rather well, an American journalist. He's got a beautiful sister who's like a Shirley Temple figure. And he has got nothing. And he blames all the things he hasn't got on outsiders. I think that's quite common, actually. I think a lot of racism comes from, you know, it's externalizing what's wrong in your life. You just choose someone to blame. And that seems to me very common. I think that's what skinhead kind of racism is about, as far as I understand it. It's a sense of disappointment and frustration with your own life, which you externalize and blame on an out-group. So that would be my answer. Shirley is loved, basically loved, and therefore can love. Dirk can't love. Dirk hasn't got a sex life. You know, he's a 20-odd-year-old boy, repressed gay, who hasn't got a sex life. And, you know, that kind of does things to you. It sounds a bit schematic talking about the book like this. I don't think it's quite like that in the experience of reading it, because the characters are much more mixed than you would think. But nevertheless, that would be my answer to that.
Okay, would you say then that Shirley chose specifically, though, to go out with black men?
I think she did. And I have known a few women like that when there was a very difficult... I mean, I don't think most mixed marriages like that at all.
No.
Not at all.
Mm.
But in Shirley's case, she does explicitly say at one point, I mean, you know, this is a man who's hit her in the face when she's pregnant. And she says she could never love a man like her father. So there is something straightforward there. She also knows it will upset her father enormously if she chooses a partner who is not white English. So in her case, but I think this is exceptional.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. The second question then would be, did you actually do any specific research into racist families or racist people in general, or is it just based on purely the experiences that you've had of living in somewhere such as Brent, which is obviously so multicultural?
I did a huge amount of talking to people. My research in this book was just talking to people.
Uh-huh.
So some of it, I have to say, comes from my own family. So some of it I knew from that. Some of it, I talked a lot to specific people, listened a lot to specific people, listened a lot to a Ghanaian friend of mine about her, very close friend of mine, about her experiences. It comes from that really. I filled notebooks with just things that people said. I did never know quite how to react when people say very racist things to me. I think it's absolutely no good just contradicting people. I think the only way you can get there is by asking questions. you know, just putting questions, destabilizing questions. And I did a lot of that around that time. That really. But in a way, I live in an area where it's very easy to research this question. The only thing that I think I should have done more of, and I didn't do this, because I didn't really know how to do it, I didn't specifically research or infiltrate any racist organizations. Mm-hmm. I didn't do that, and perhaps I should have done that. But I was a bit afraid to do it, and I didn't quite know how to do it, so I have to say I didn't do that. But I felt this boy was so feeble in any way, he probably wouldn't get into anything as organized as a, you know, as a group. Yes. Perfectly true, yes. I don't think I'd call it the contextualization of racism, but I did look at the way that Dirk, who is my racist boy, he gets over it completely with the first husband, Kojo, because they're both interested in football. So they love football. And so Shirley thinks it's all right. And then after Kojo dies, she is amazed when he starts it all over again with her new partner. So it's as if, you know, he's learned with this guy, but he can't learn anything more general. So I suppose that is what we're talking about, contextualization, yeah. I think that's very important, but it doesn't necessarily help because you've got to have a lot of those encounters, haven't you? And maybe after a lot of those encounters, some of that initial prejudice gets broken down. And in a lot of parts of Britain, and through a lot of the choices that people make as well, you can avoid those kind of encounters, perhaps, or some people try and avoid those encounters. But it's almost not possible to do it in London now. I think the reason why London is such an exciting city is because it's probably the most culturally and racially mixed city in Europe, I would say, which is makes it a very exciting place to live. Yes?
You talked about the book as a journey.
Yes. No, you're not seduced by it, but interested by it. I felt I got more of an understanding of it, because what we tend to do, it's so embarrassing and appalling, isn't it, when people say things, that you tend to just move away or put a lid on it in some way. I didn't find it seductive, but I found it more comprehensible. I found it more understandable. Yes. I mean, in a way, there is a sense, which is outside of real life, where as a writer, you have to love your characters, or your characters are just cardboard figures. So to that extent, when I'm writing Alfred, it's pointless disapproving of Alfred all the time. It's pointless. I know I would, in real life. I wouldn't like him. I wouldn't like him. But as a writer, you're operating in a different way. It's an imaginative act that's taking place. I have to give him space, as I have to give the others. I think my racist boy, Dirk, I couldn't quite give space to, because the way he thinks is so shocking. So I separated myself from him by mocking him, as I wrote him. Do you see? I mean, he's comic. The mistakes he makes are comic. That could be dangerous in that it's dangerous to think that all racists are stupid. They're not, unfortunately. But that's the way I dealt with it. And he's not unsympathetic. He has reasons to be the way he is. I think there are always, you know, if you understood everything, you wouldn't judge anything. But we have to, don't we? Because we have to live. So there we are. shall I read a bit more? Or are there people who really want to ask questions? Because when I was writing the book, I wasn't thinking like this. When I was writing the book, I was writing the book. I was telling a story and making patterns, but because of the subject of this book, it's bound to be dealt with a bit by subject. It was a fearful book to write because you can annoy everybody by writing a book like this. You know, you can get it wrong from the point of view of absolutely everybody. It's still something that is unspeakable in a way, I think.
Have you had a lot of feedback from the black community then in terms of how they see the racism within the book?
Well, the best encouragement I had, the most encouragement I had, this book was turned down by a lot of publishers. It's the only book of mine since my first that that's happened to. Yes, that's more or less true. And it was black writers who then encouraged me. I was going to give up. And I showed it to Mike Phillips, who was writer in residence at the Festival Hall. I just said, obviously, I've got this completely wrong. I didn't, you know, it's a big thing to ask a writer to read your work, I think. So I went to a writer who, it was part of his job description, so he had to do it. And no, he's very encouraging. And since then, I've had terrific encouragement, really, from black people, because to them it's ordinary. The racism is ordinary. It's white people who are more shocked by it, I think, on the whole. Okay, I'm going to read a bit. I was going to finish Alfred, but I think instead I'll read a bit of Shirley, who's different. Or shall I finish that Alfred passage? How about a vote? Who wants Shirley? Okay, and who wants Alfred? Oh, well, that's about equal, I think. Shirley's shorter. And Shirley is on page 2. Shirley is on page 127. Whenever it rained, Shirley thought about Kojo. He said English rain was quiet, like tears. When it rained on Saturdays, we stayed in bed, Kojo and I. We loved to be naked. Can that have been me? Can life have been so good? Naked in a nest of sheets, his beautiful, warm, slender body curled round mine, stroking, playing, and then inside me, he spent hours inside me. I'd bring up our breakfast, we'd eat together, slowly, ravenously, still sleepy, jazz on the radio, rain on the window, the smoke from his fags curling up in the light. I liked the smell, it was part of the music, the smell of Kojo and our life together. How many cigarettes did I light for him? The curve of his lips with the tip between them, smiling at me, staring at me. His beautiful lips, so full, so firm, not tight and thin like English lips. My lovely love, my African love, maybe he's with his ancestors. He was westernized, he dismissed all that, but I think that part of him still believed it. He said he was a Marxist, but these things go deep. If he could be a Marxist and a Christian, he could be a Christian and believe in spirits. I hope he's with his ancestors. I can't believe he is entirely lost. I knew nothing about Africa when I met him. I thought all black people were Africans. My dad hated black people, of course, and he called them colored, so I did too. Though whatever dad hated, I was ready to like. I never knew colored was insulting till Kojo told me not to say it. I asked him the difference between coloured and black, and he said, right now, you're blushing, Shirley. When you're upset, you turn every kind of colour. Don't you think white skins colour more than ours? It was another world, with another way of thinking. Elroy's family, that's the new husband, is Jamaican, though he was born in South London. That's partly why Elroy is jealous of Kojo, because he was African and so highly educated. West Indians sometimes don't like Africans, and I always think it's jealousy. Africans have their own names, after all. West Indians don't. White people stole them. I felt so ashamed when Kojo told me that West Indian names are all slave names, slave owners stamping their names forever. And then there are the Africans who don't like West Indians. Slave babies, they call them. The worst insult. Elroy's lighter than Kojo. He had one white grandmother. Kojo was black, dark, dark, beautiful black, a black with a sheen of coal or grapes. I loved his skin. I licked his skin, the blue-black, shining West African skin, the skin of princes, emperors, giving back light, black, full of light. Now Kojo's dead. At last, his family accepts me. His sister, Abinga, brings his children over from Ghana to stay. To begin with, we were shy with each other. The little girl stared at me deep into my eyes, touched my hair, tried to plait it, sat on my lap and stroked my face. At first, my whiteness hypnotized them. Their mother seemed frightened or hostile on arrival, but she was grudgingly impressed when I cooked them dinner. Jollof rice with chicken and corned beef, and plantain on the side, great steaming platefuls, palm soup and peanut soup, so many choices. Not bad for an abroni, she said, but you need more ginger. Didn't Kojo tell you? I said to her firmly, he loved my food. I preferred a feast, enough for 10 people to show them they were welcome, to show them I could do it. I so much wanted to be part of his family. But she still hadn't got over the dispute about the will. She smiled at me, but her eyes didn't smile. She said, no abroni, white person, could cook fufu or banku. I put them on the table, fufu, banku, the consistency exactly right, stodgy, starchy, but not heavy. Still, despite the sorrows, my family number one, and the morons who said cruel things on the street, against all the odds, Kojo and I were happy. Though there were sorrows and differences, Ashanti men may not enter the kitchen. I told him that modern British men all did, but I happily cooked for him. I cared for him, loved him, and he cared for me. He cared for me. We left our families to be together. We had to be all in all to each other. Beneath us, the everlasting arms. We thought there would be so many years. Stupid tears. They never run dry. So that's a very different kind of voice, you see. Though in a way, this whole family, apart from Dirk, are quite, they've both got sort of lyrical sides. Alfred is very lyrical when he remembers the war in the park. I think you can sometimes see that in the voices of families, although they've had totally different educational experiences or whatever. Something is similar. There's kind of a heartbeat that's the same in some way. Any more questions? Okay, this question is the book allegorical? Is it about post-war England? Yes, of course. But somehow, these things exist together in your mind as a writer. I'm inventing the people, I'm believing in the people, I'm using a lot of experience that's real first-hand experience, but at the same time, I'm making it unreal or more universal by the names like Albion Park. I was also writing about the breakdown, loss of public things, loss of libraries, loss of hospitals, loss of parks. And to me, this is linked to racist violence, because if you get rid of the spaces people can share, the public spaces, you know, there's less possibility for people to be together. And where there's more poverty, and where there's bigger gaps between rich and poor, there's more hatred, I think. So I was trying to say that. And I think, although this book got largely very good reviews, some people don't like the allegorical strand. They don't like it because it's too obvious to have Albion Park, but I think it's a way of being economical. I don't mind pointing to the unreality of something. I don't mind. I'm really glad your readers group thought that, because that's exactly what I meant, and I wanted people to see that. And I was writing about the past 50 years in a way. Then that way, I think what that lady said I can relate to. I was also trying to talk about post-war Britain, because to me it's still a breath from the Second World War. Although, I mean, of course, I was born after it, but I do see us as very traumatized still by the First and Second World War, I think. Any more questions? Be brave, you've got one, yes. Okay, question about the basis of character and whether philosophy fuels my characters. It's not like that. It's a good question, but it's not like that. I suppose I've been influenced like everybody else by Freud. you know, have to have been, we all have been, even if we reject it, insofar as we believe that we're influenced by our childhoods. That's a Freudian idea, isn't it? And we're affected by... I was deeply, deeply affected by my family, and I could never have written this book until my parents were dead. But in a way, I'm not thinking in abstractions at all when I'm writing. It's tremendously concrete. Everything I write, I see. It's all happening. A lot of novelists would tell you that. I interviewed Anita Desai recently, the wonderful, I think absolutely wonderful novelist. And if you know her work, you'll know it's tremendously detailed and colourful and vivid. And she says she sees it all. And I see it all, which means, of course, some things are upsetting. But there's no abstractions come into play other than at the stage of editing. And I edit an enormous amount. And there, I do cut down, and I suppose if I felt a certain... Say I felt that The Prejudice had got too much of an outing. You know what I mean? If I felt I'd given it too much space, it would be at that editing stage that my own opinions would come in. Okay? So it's not... I don't think you should write from opinion, but maybe you can edit partly from opinion. And this book has been the most edited of any of my books, and I still felt I needed a good editor. I always feel despairing when writers say they don't need editors. We all need editors. You all need another good mind coming from outside. You can say no, but it's so helpful. I've got time for one more question, I think, or maybe a few more. Yes. Oh, were you just... Oh, yes. Yes, could have been. Could have been, yeah. Could have been, and that's one of the memorable depictions of racism in sitcom. I didn't see all of them, but I saw some, and he was unforgettable. Absolutely, this is an aside, but he's unforgettable in Miller's The Price at the moment, playing an utterly different character, and he must be in his 80s, totally dominates the stage. I mean, it was very memorable. And I think that was interesting, interesting but unshaded, you know, as a depiction of a person. We were never given any, that's something novels can do, of course. It's one of the great luxuries for a writer. We can move in time. Though I haven't had enough, if you hasten to add, I haven't had any analysis. But, you know, yeah, we're all influenced by him, aren't we? Yes?
Yes.
I did, but this is specifically, I call it the White Family. I called it at first, I began it, Keeper of the Gate. Winston is a character, because he's linked to the family. But on the whole, I was talking about, you see, this is why I chose to use white characters, mostly white characters. Because I think it is one of the annoying things about being a writer of colour is that racism is thought to be your concern. You know, why should only black people and black writers write about racism? Because racism in this country is very much a white concern. And so I, as a white writer, wanted to write about white people's prejudices, mostly. Okay? So I have done some of that. But of course, there's always a kind of slight nervousness about maybe stealing people's experience. Now, this is a political issue, and I don't go along with it myself, and I've got black characters in my new novel. But I did have slight anxieties about it, and so I thought it was easier for me to look at this family and stay within this family for quite a lot of the book. It seems.
So it's like your kind of dialogue of racism is just working on that and using them as a purely a subject.
Have you read the book, though?
Well, no, but we're in the excerpts we've just read. They're not granted their own voice.
I mean, well, I think you have to read the book before you say that. You have read White Teeth, have you?
Yeah.
I think you have to read the book before you say that, actually. It's not really like that, but I mean, it's. I see that you're. I'm not just taking it as a subject. My way into this subject was through my friends, of whom, and I have many black friends. So, if that answers your question, but I didn't take it as a subject to exploit. If that's your, is that your question? You said I'm just taking it as a subject. Perhaps explain that a bit more.
Well, I mean, a lot of the suburbs have become post-colonial literature.
A lot of
African writers, Caribbean writers, people say, you know, the best thing to do is that we should read texts from other cultures, we should read more, we should learn more. And this is why it's good that these kind of depictions of the black body being, you know, eroticized, just used kind of fed upon.
Combating tribalism. I think you'll find tribalism is not a term that we're. I'm talking about a white woman who is in love with a specific black man who she's talking about. So, you know, it's not an object. I'm talking about sex between a specific white woman and a specific black man. So, you know, one has to talk about if you're thinking about a lover, you have to, in some way, he is the subject of your thoughts, the subject and object of your thoughts. But read the novel, and maybe you'll see things a bit differently. Anyone else? Yes. Well, thank you. That's very kind. I think perhaps the answer to your question is that black writers, you know, black writers and intellectuals have responded very well to this book, and in a way, it's their opinion of that side of things that I'm more interested in. Though I'm interested in everyone's opinion, of course.
I think the book, though, is an examination of the views of a white family, isn't it?
Yes.
You're not trying to give the views of a black family,
exactly,
from the point of being abused through racism. What you're trying to do through the book is just say the family who are the white family because their surname is white, as well as them being a white family, and you just want to give the whole spectrum of views on racism from that one family. If that's how I understood it from actually reading the book, and I think before, you know, it would be probably wrong of you to actually try and write from a black person's point of view anyway, wouldn't it? Because you're not.
Well, this is a moot point. I now think we have to try and imagine each other. I think we have to try and write everybody, but I was nervous about it. I have to say I was nervous about it. And I thought the thing I could do most honestly was try and understand this family. Not, you know, to understand the spectrum of prejudice. And through that, to understand other kinds of prejudice. You know, there's so many kinds of prejudice. I think, you know, writers just, you, in a way, you can't do what you don't do. Do you see? A book is what it is, and you have to sort of look at the whole thing and try and understand what the book does from that point of view, I think. Novelists always have a slight problem. We're not like poets. We can't present the whole thing at a reading. You know, we have to take extracts, and that has a very simplifying effect, I think. Okay, any more? One last question, then we must go. Yes, sorry. Yes. I don't think it could be harder to write from a black person's point of view, because In most ways, you know, there's no, there would be no difference about most things, would there? It would only be... I think it's great fun to write through someone else. I enjoy writing through male characters. I enjoy writing through characters who are different from me. In fact, the most boring bits for me are characters who are too near me. They're very hard to do well, characters who are near you. I always find myself satirizing them. I don't know about that. I mean, Jane's there. I don't know if you feel that. It's hard to write characters who are near to your own, because you're not inventing. There isn't a friction. There isn't a gap. There's a sort of gap between you and your characters that sometimes gives a charge to what you're writing, I think. I think characters are characters, and the human truths are fairly universal. So perhaps the kind of fears we have, we shouldn't have. I think perhaps we have to try and invent and imagine each other. That's the point of fiction. And I think that's all I'm going to say. Thank you for coming, Omar.